Well, I'd like to start today with a quick review of the last 4 weeks in John, specifically the geography. Because geography matters for today's two stories. On January 9, we were in Cana of Galilee, John chapter 2, for the story about the wedding at Cana. Cana is in the northern half of Palestine above Samaria. It was Jesus' first venture into the public eye when he was sort of drafted by his mother to perform a miracle to rescue a wedding reception that ran out of wine. Then John 2 notes, Jesus did this, the first of his signs, in Cana of Galilee. And that sign revealed Jesus' glory and many believed in him. So the next story, one Sunday later, also in John 2, takes place at the temple in Jerusalem, the center of religious and political power. About 90 to 100 miles south, more or less, because as far as we know, this time he did the normal bypass around Samaria, 5 days of walking for someone in good shape. And what Jesus did in Jerusalem, clearing the temple of a worship industry that exploited people, caused a ruckus, to put it mildly. Still, many came to believe in him, it says, but it also made him many enemies, it's safe to say. One Sunday later, we are still geographically down near Jerusalem in John 3. The well-connected and influential Pharisee Nicodemus came to visit Jesus in the night to ask some searching theological questions. And we don't know how Nicodemus ultimately responded, but the scene is set up in such a way that it sure seems it's not a safe way of life, either for Jesus or for those closely connected to him. Jesus and the disciples then spent some time in the countryside around Judea, around Jerusalem. Maybe everyone was happier when Jesus was doing his thing out in the country and not right under the noses of the power elite. In any case, last Sunday, John 4, Jesus heads back to Galilee again. This time, he made the bold choice to go straight through Samaria, a region other self-respecting Jews avoided, and he had this deep and penetrating conversation and scandalous conversation with a Samaritan woman by the well. And he stayed there in Samaria for some days. And then we come to today's passage, beginning at the end of John 4. It says, he went from that place to Galilee, for Jesus himself had testified that a prophet has no honor in the prophet's own country. And when he came to Galilee, the Galileans welcomed him, since they had seen all that he had done in Jerusalem at the festival, for they too had gone to the festival. Now, are you starting to get this geographical picture? Jesus, who had been sent as a healing, saving Messiah to the world, is received quite differently up north and down south. Geographically speaking, Palestine is kind of the reverse of the eastern United States. Here, the old guard political, economic, and intellectual centers are mostly in the north, and the South is sometimes treated a bit dismissively by the northern elite. In Palestine, in Jesus' day, it was the same way, except just swap north and south. There was even a saying in the South, "Can anything good come from Nazareth, that backward city up north?" In the opening prologue in John 1, we heard these words. Jesus came to his own, but his own did not receive him. Yet to all who did receive him, to those who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God. His own people were down south. His family line, at least through Joseph, was rooted in Bethlehem, the city of David, right outside Jerusalem. He'd been schooled in the traditions of the temple. He was a rabbi. Down south is where he was from, so to speak, when he received his religious formation. But Galilee, up north, also ran in Jesus' blood. He grew up in Nazareth. He chose a good many disciples from Galilee. He hung out in Capernaum and other towns bordering the Sea of Galilee and seemed quite at home up north, farther away from the ruling elite. Jesus had more room to move, had more people cheering him on up north. John said it outright. When he got back to Galilee, he was welcomed because of what he did in Jerusalem at the festival. Interesting. You know, the Galileans were there too. And they saw Jesus clear out the temple, and they were not offended. I'm guessing they were the ones being liberated by Jesus' prophetic actions against the animal merchants and money changers. Maybe they had been swindled often enough to get some pleasure watching what Jesus did in the temple. Anyway, the first thing that Jesus does when back in Cana of Galilee is this healing story we heard today. Jesus heals not a son or daughter of Israel, but a Gentile child of a Roman royal officer. And what's the result? More people believed. More people saw God's glory revealed in Jesus. And from what we can tell, very little pushback for showing compassion to someone outside the family. And John says, this was the second sign pointing to Jesus' glory, and he did it in Galilee. And then what happens next in John? Jesus heads back south. He went to Jerusalem for another festival. John doesn't specify how much time elapsed because it's not that important. In fact, chronology and sequence is not all that important to John's telling of the gospel. It's not really relevant whether Jesus actually and physically went back and forth between the north and south as often as John says, or in that order that John wrote it down. Because John is painting a theological and political picture of Jesus that's gradually coming into focus. At this festival in Jerusalem, something scandalous happens again. It might not seem scandalous to us. Seems like just another beautiful and miraculous healing story. But it sparked a very different response than the first healing up north. A man, lame for most of his life, couldn't get his feet into the healing pool in time whenever the waters were stirred. So he stayed crippled for 38 years. That in itself is a sharp indictment against a religious system that couldn't come up with any better plan to help this poor man. Jesus simply speaks the word. Get up, pick up your mat, and walk. And at once, he walks. Beautiful, marvelous. Round of applause. Everybody rejoices. No, actually, that's not how it goes down. Not here in Jerusalem, home of the temple and its rule keepers. Here, it's a scandal. Because the day is a Sabbath. And the scandal gets set off not by the healing act itself, because that apparently happened quietly and unseen for the most part. The problem came to light when the man was spotted carrying his mat on the Sabbath. And it's forbidden to carry a mat on the Sabbath. The religious institution failed this man on two fronts. He lay by the pool for decades with no one to intervene to help him get to the water. And the moment he was able to walk, Rather than rejoicing that he can walk, he gets called out for walking with his mat on the Sabbath. The religious inquisitors then tried to find out who had the nerve to heal him on the Sabbath and instruct him to carry his mat. So incensed were they by this flagrant breaking of Sabbath law that John tells us that the persecution of Jesus began in earnest. And when Jesus added further offense by claiming God as Father, they started conspiring to kill him. So that's where the story stops for now. So what is the good news for our day, for our present context? Well, the extent of woundedness in our community and our world is as great as anything I've seen in my lifetime. We are wounded and weary beyond comprehension. Obviously, the COVID pandemic is a big part of that, but so much more has cut us down and traumatized us. Wounds that are physical, relational, emotional, psychological, societal, political, and spiritual. So much of the misbehavior that we witness around us, from mean-spirited discourse to actually shooting people to death, from individual acts of aggression to mob violence and insurrection, does not come out of the blue. It comes from our woundedness. It comes from places that need healing more than legislation. I'm not saying legislation isn't needed. It is, without a doubt. And I'll get behind any good and just piece of legislation. But healing cannot be legislated. And healing is the central call of the church. God's mission is healing, and we are God's collaborators. It's that simple, and it's that complex, and demanding, and difficult. In Palestine, Jesus healed up north and down south. It mattered not whether the wounded was a poor Jewish leper or a wealthy religious leader, or a member of the Roman occupying army. It mattered not whether the wounding was from being socially cut off and marginalized from the community, or from a physical, emotional, or spiritual disease. The public response to Jesus' healings would vary according to the context, including geography, and according to whose agenda got disrupted by the healing. But Jesus healed here, there, and everywhere. And so must we. It's so easy to draw lines and create enemies and enemy groups that then fall outside the realm of our responsibility to heal. But we must be committed to everyone's healing. Everyone's, no matter whose side they are aligned with, no matter what type of woundedness they suffer from. If we are not thus committed, we are not following Jesus.